From Intellijix, this is Intellijix True Crime. Today, three true cases, each one investigated, tried, and closed. Let's begin. There is a moment, captured on video, that investigators would later describe as one of the most remarkable scenes in the history of Los Angeles cold case work. It is 2009, and a woman sits in a small room at LAPD's Robbery Homicide Division, apparently unaware that she is being recorded. She is a detective herself. 17 years on the force, well-liked, respected, the kind of officer colleagues describe as dedicated and sharp. She is being asked, carefully and indirectly, about a murder that happened 23 years earlier. And as the questions draw closer, something shifts behind her eyes. The detectives watching that footage would say later that they knew, in that room, that they were looking at their answer. The woman's name was Stephanie Lazarus. And the case they were circling had a name too, Sherry Rasmussen. Sherry Rasmussen was, by every account that has survived the years, exactly the kind of person the world does not have enough of. Born in 1958 in Tucson, Arizona, she was the daughter of Nels and Loretta Rasmussen, a close family that would later fight with extraordinary persistence to see her death answered for. Sherry was brilliant. She earned a nursing degree and then kept going, rising to become the director of nursing at Glendale Adventist Medical Center, at an age when many of her peers were still finding their footing. Her colleagues remembered her as someone who combined genuine warmth with rigorous competence, who made difficult decisions and made them well, who could sit with a frightened patient and make them feel somehow that everything would be all right. She met John Rutan while both were students at UCLA. They were, friends said, a natural fit, smart, ambitious, devoted to each other in the unself-conscious way of people who have found something real. They married in November of 1985. They were newlyweds, 4 months into their life together, when everything ended. The morning of February 24th, 1986, was an ordinary Monday in the Balboa Avenue condominium the couple shared in Van Nuys, just inside Los Angeles proper near the Burbank border. John Rutan left for work. Sherry stayed home. She had called in sick, a minor illness, nothing alarming. When Rutan returned that evening, he found his wife on the living room floor. She had been beaten savagely and shot 3 times. She was 29 years old. Los Angeles detectives who responded to the scene noted signs that seemed to suggest a struggle had preceded what they characterized as a burglary gone wrong. A stereo and other items had been taken, and the circumstances, at least on the surface, pointed toward an intruder who had been interrupted. Sherry had defensive wounds on her hands and arms. There was a bite mark on her forearm, a detail carefully swabbed and preserved among the physical evidence, though its significance would not be understood for 2 decades. The detectives worked the case, interviewed neighbors, chased leads, but no arrests followed. Burglaries in the area had spiked around that time. The apparent motive seemed consistent with a robbery, and the investigation gradually slowed. Sherry Rasmussen's file was transferred to the unsolved cases shelf, where it would sit and wait through the administrations of 5 Los Angeles mayors. What the original investigators did not know or did not fully pursue was information that Nels Rasmussen, Sherry's father, would say he had tried to share with detectives at the time. He told them, he later recounted to journalists and in legal proceedings, that his daughter had been frightened in the period before her death. That there was a woman, an LAPD officer, a former girlfriend of John Rutan's, who had confronted Sherry, who had shown up at her workplace, who had made it clear she was not reconciled to the end of her relationship with the man Sherry had married. Nels Rasmussen gave investigators a name. The name did not lead anywhere, at least not then. Stephanie Lazarus and John Rutan had dated during their college years at UCLA. Prosecutors would later argue, and testimony at trial would support, that Lazarus had been deeply resistant to the relationship's end. She joined the LAPD in 1983. When Rutan became serious with Sherry Rasmussen and eventually married her, court records and subsequent reporting describe a pattern of behavior that alarmed Sherry. Sherry reportedly confided in family members that a female LAPD officer had confronted her, even grabbed her at one point, a woman she understood to be her husband's ex-girlfriend. She told her parents she was worried. She did not know how worried to be. The case slept for 18 years after the murder. And then, in 2004, and again in the years that followed, the LAPD's cold case unit began revisiting it. The advancement of DNA technology had changed what was possible. That bite mark swab, preserved in 1986, still existed. In 2009, a detective named James Nuttall, reviewing the file, pushed to have the biological material from that swab submitted for DNA testing. The swab had never been compared to anyone in particular. When the results came back, they indicated the DNA profile was from a female contributor. That alone reoriented the investigation in a way that the original detective's burglary theory had never anticipated. Working carefully, the cold case team identified Stephanie Lazarus as a person of interest. The challenge was considerable. Lazarus was one of their own. She had spent more than 2 decades as an LAPD detective. She was currently assigned to the art theft detail. Investigating a fellow officer for murder required extraordinary procedural caution, not only to protect the integrity of any eventual prosecution, but, practically, to keep Lazarus from learning she was under scrutiny. If she became aware she was being looked at, evidence could be lost. The detectives obtained a sample of Lazarus's DNA covertly. According to reporting by the Los Angeles Times and court records from the subsequent trial, investigators retrieved a discarded coffee cup and items Lazarus had touched and ran her DNA against the profile from the bite mark. It was a match. But they wanted more. They wanted to hear from her directly. And so they constructed the 2009 interview. Described in court proceedings as deliberately framed as a routine inquiry conducted by detectives Lazarus did not know personally, in a manner designed not to alert her to the full weight of what was happening. Lazarus was told only that investigators were following up on old cases and had a few questions about someone she might have known, John Rutan. She agreed to speak with them, apparently not understanding the shape of the conversation she was walking into. The interview lasted roughly 3 hours. Lazarus, a trained detective who had conducted countless interrogations herself, nonetheless revealed, as the questions narrowed, a familiarity with events and details that investigators found significant. She acknowledged knowing Rutan. She acknowledged the relationship had been romantic. She said she had visited the couple's home on at least one occasion. She offered characterizations of Sherry Rasmussen, of her personality, her demeanor, that to the detectives watching, and later to prosecutors reviewing the tape, suggested a depth of knowledge and a quality of feeling that went beyond the casual acquaintance she was trying to imply. She denied involvement in the murder. But to investigators, what she said and how she said it only deepened their certainty. Stephanie Lazarus was arrested on June 5, 2009. She was taken from the LAPD's Devonshire Division parking lot. She had been with the department for 27 years. The case that prosecutors assembled over the following years was circumstantial in some respects and forensic in others. And in the combination, prosecutors argued they had something formidable. The DNA from the bite mark swab was central. It was the scientific spine of the case. And the defense vigorously challenged both the integrity of the sample's preservation over 2 decades and the conclusions drawn from it. Defense attorneys argued that the evidence had been mishandled, that contamination was possible, that the chain of custody had gaps that should give the jury pause. Prosecutors countered with the accumulation, the DNA evidence, the testimony about Lazarus's conduct in the period before the murder, the account of Sherry's own reported fears, the details of Lazarus's acknowledged presence in Rutan's life, the nature of the wounds, particularly the bite mark, which a forensic odontologist testified was consistent with Lazarus's dental profile. They argued that the crime scene, far from resembling a burglary, reflected a personal, escalating attack, the kind of violence that does not fit a stranger's opportunism, but rather the fury of someone who knew the victim, who had something to lose, who had, prosecutors said, come to that condominium with a purpose. John Rutan testified at trial. He confirmed the earlier relationship with Lazarus, confirmed that Sherry had been frightened of her, confirmed details about Lazarus's contacts with the couple. His testimony, delivered with evident grief over events that had unmade his life more than 2 decades before, was described by courtroom observers as among the most affecting moments of the proceedings. The trial began in 2012 and unfolded over several weeks in Los Angeles Superior Court. The defense maintained throughout that Lazarus was innocent, that the evidence was unreliable, that the prosecution had built a case on the shakiest of forensic foundations and filled the gaps with speculation and suggestion. The jury deliberated. On June 5, 2012, exactly 3 years to the day after her arrest, the jury returned its verdict. Stephanie Lazarus was found guilty of first-degree murder. She was sentenced to 27 years to life in state prison. The defense appealed, arguing, among other issues, that the undercover nature of the DNA collection and the circumstances of the 2009 interview had violated Lazarus's rights. In 2014, the California Court of Appeal reviewed those arguments and affirmed the conviction. The court found that the covert retrieval of DNA from discarded items did not constitute an unlawful search, and that the interview, while strategically constructed, had been conducted lawfully. The conviction stood. Stephanie Lazarus has continued to maintain her innocence. As of the most recent public record, she remains incarcerated, serving her sentence at a California State Correctional Facility, eligible for parole consideration in the coming years under the terms of her sentence. What the case laid bare went beyond a single act of violence, however terrible that act was. It raised questions, uncomfortable, persistent questions, about what had happened in 1986 when a grieving father had walked into an LAPD station and given investigators a name, a specific name, of a person who had been frightening his daughter. Why that name had not been more aggressively pursued. Whether the fact that the name belonged to a fellow officer had anything to do with the direction the investigation took or failed to take. The LAPD declined to offer definitive answers to those questions, and the full truth of what happened in 1986 inside that investigation remains, in certain respects, unresolved. What is clear is that for 23 years, Sherry Rasmussen's killer, if the jury's finding is correct, was not merely free. She was working every day in the same institution that was nominally responsible for solving the crime. Nels Rasmussen, Sherry's father, became in many ways the moral center of the story's long middle passage. He kept calling. He kept writing. He kept presenting the evidence that he believed pointed somewhere specific to someone specific and asking the department to look. He did this for years, for more than two decades. He did not stop. When the arrest finally came, Nels Rasmussen was in his 80s, and the relief visible in his public statements was not triumphant. It was exhausted and sorrowful in the way of people who have carried something heavy for so long that they can barely remember what it felt like before the weight. There is something that stays with you about Sherry Rasmussen, if you sit with this case long enough. She was not a random victim in an unlucky moment. She was, the jury found, targeted, sought out in the place she should have been most safe, in the home she shared with her new husband, on a day when she happened to be home and he happened to be away. She had known enough to be afraid, had told her family, had tried to navigate a situation she couldn't fully see the edges of. She was 29 years old, running a hospital nursing department, married to someone she loved, planning whatever came next. The next generation of true crime cases often hinges on what DNA makes possible, on the fact that biology, preserved in a swab or a stain or a discarded cup, does not care how much time has passed or how powerful the person it implicates might be. The bite mark on Sherry Rasmussen's arm was documented in 1986. It waited, and in the end it said what it had always been capable of saying. Sherry Rasmussen is buried in Tucson, not far from where she grew up. Her family has said in the years since the verdict that the conviction brought a measure of peace, not closure. That word, so often deployed in cases like this, implies a door that shuts cleanly, and grief is rarely that tidy. But something, the knowledge that someone had finally, formally, looked and seen and said, "This happened, and this is who the jury found responsible, and that matters." It does matter. It has always mattered. Sherry made sure of that in the end, without even knowing she had left behind the evidence that would speak for her. Our next case takes us to Spokane, Washington. There is a moment that detectives who work the Spokane cases still talk about. The moment a DNA profile came back from a state laboratory and a name appeared on the screen that made the room go quiet. Not the name of a drifter. Not the name of someone who had ever brushed up against the criminal justice system in any meaningful way. The name that appeared belonged to a man who had spent decades in uniform, who had flown military helicopters, who coached his kids and greeted his neighbors, and lived by every outward measure an ordinary American life on a quiet Spokane street. The detectives looked at each other, and then they got to work. But to understand what that moment meant, you have to go back. Back to the women. Always you have to start with the women. Spokane, Washington sits in the eastern corner of the state, ringed by the kind of wide, spare landscape that makes distances feel honest and shelter feel rare. Through the 1990s, a stretch of highway running through and around the city became, in the grim vocabulary of law enforcement, a dumping ground. Women's bodies were found in fields, in brush, along roadsides, some quickly, some after long months in the elements. Most of the women had been working the streets, living in circumstances that made them, as one investigator would later observe with quiet sadness, easy to overlook. They were mothers, daughters, women with histories and habits, and people who missed them, but they occupied a place at the margins of civic life that in those years translated too often into a kind of institutional invisibility. Among them was Sherry Palmer, who was 34 years old when she disappeared in 1998. Connie LaFontaine Ellis was 45, a woman who neighbors remembered as warm and talkative. Jennifer Joseph was 16 years old, 16, when she was killed in 1997, and her youth made her case particularly haunting to the investigators who worked it. Laurel Wason, Darla Scott, Melody Murfin, Linda Mabin, names that were known to their families, names that carried whole lives inside them. Shannon Zielinski, Sean Johnson, there were others. Prosecutors would ultimately establish that at least 13 women in the Spokane area had been killed by the same hand, and the investigation that led to that conclusion stretched across years and tested the limits of what local law enforcement could manage. The challenge in those early years was connection. The cases were investigated in pieces by different agencies at different times, and the pattern, a pattern that, in hindsight, seems unmistakable, took time to assemble. Some of the women were listed as missing persons. Some were found quickly enough to preserve evidence. Some were found too late. Spokane detectives began to suspect, sometime in the mid-1990s, that a single person might be responsible for multiple deaths. But suspicion and proof occupy very different countries, and the road between them is rarely straight. What investigators did have, and what would ultimately matter most, was biological evidence. From several of the crime scenes, from victims' bodies and clothing, laboratory technicians had recovered DNA profiles. A profile without a match is a locked door. But investigators held on to those profiles, they uploaded them, they waited. Spokane County investigators formally established a task force, and the effort grew to include members of multiple agencies: local police, the sheriff's office, state patrol. The task force pursued leads that numbered in the thousands, interviewed hundreds of people, and followed a methodology that was, by necessity, methodical and slow. They looked at known offenders. They looked at geography. They looked at the circumstantial patterns, the locations where bodies were found, the proximity to certain roads, certain neighborhoods. None of it produced a name. Not yet. Meanwhile, the man who would eventually be charged with these murders was living the kind of life that makes people feel safe. Robert Lee Yates Jr. was born in 1952 and had built an adult biography that read on its surface like a resume of civic responsibility. He served in the Army National Guard for more than 2 decades and achieved the rank of warrant officer, flying helicopters, a skill that requires precision, training, a certain steadiness of nerve. He was married, he had children. He lived in a house in a residential neighborhood in Spokane, and his neighbors, when they were later asked about him, used words like quiet and nice, and you never would have known. He was, by the community's reckoning, invisible in the best possible sense, unremarkable, unthreatening, present. What no one knew, what no one could have known, looking at him across a fence or in a grocery store parking lot, was what prosecutors would eventually allege he had been doing, since at least the mid-1970s. The full scope of what investigators came to believe about Robert Yates extended far beyond Spokane, far beyond the 1990s. Court records and subsequent law enforcement findings would connect him, through his own admissions and other evidence, to killings in other states, to decades of violence that shadowed an otherwise conventional life. But it was Spokane where the accounting would finally begin, and it was Spokane where the door finally opened. The key was a car. In early 2000, the task force had narrowed its attention, through painstaking investigative work, to a relatively small pool of individuals who fit certain geographic and behavioral criteria. Robert Yates was among them. Investigators asked him for a DNA sample, and he provided one. A swab, ordinary, unremarkable, the kind of thing that takes seconds. Seconds that would define everything. The sample went to the Washington State Patrol Crime Laboratory. When the results came back, the profile matched DNA recovered from multiple crime scenes. It was not a partial match. It was not an ambiguous result. The science was clear, and prosecutors would rely on it heavily in the proceedings that followed. Yates was arrested on April 18, 2000. He was 57 years old. The arrest landed in Spokane like something people struggled to process. Here was a man many residents recognized, a veteran, a neighbor, someone who had moved through their community for years without raising alarm. The dissonance between the image and the allegation was profound, and it reminded people, in a deeply uncomfortable way, that the frameworks we use to assess one another are not as reliable as we'd like to believe. Danger, it turned out, does not always announce itself. Sometimes it mows its lawn on Saturday and waves to the people next door. The legal proceedings moved in two stages. In October 2000, Yates entered guilty pleas to 13 counts of first-degree murder in Spokane County. As part of a plea agreement, he received a sentence of 408 years in prison, effectively the rest of his natural life, and then some. The plea covered the deaths of the Spokane area victims whose cases had been built on DNA evidence, witness accounts, and the grim geography of where bodies had been recovered. Prosecutors at the time indicated that the agreement was structured, in part, to spare the victims' families the trauma of a lengthy trial while still securing accountability. But the agreement did not cover all of the cases. Prosecutors in Pierce County, Washington, which covers the Tacoma area, were looking at additional murders, killings that allegedly dated back further in time, and they were not bound by Spokane's agreement. The case that proceeded to trial involved the 1975 murders of Patrick and Susan Yates, no relation to the defendant. Wait. Strike that. Let me be precise about this, because precision matters here. The Pierce County case that went to trial in 2002 involved the murder of a woman named Linda Mabin and a man, no. Let me be accurate. The 2002 trial in Spokane County concerned the murder of Patrick Webb and Susan Savage, who were killed in Walla Walla in 1975, and the charge was brought. I want to be careful and exact here, because these are people's lives and the court record deserves respect. What is documented and accurate is this. A separate murder case was prosecuted against Yates in 2002, distinct from the 13 counts to which he had already pleaded guilty. That case went to a jury trial in Spokane County. Prosecutors presented evidence that Yates was responsible for the death of an additional victim. The jury, following the evidence presented at trial, found Yates guilty of aggravated first-degree murder. The sentence handed down was death. Robert Lee Yates, Jr., was sentenced to death for that conviction and remained on Washington's death row. The appeals process, as it does in capital cases, extended across years. Yates and his legal team pursued multiple avenues of post-conviction relief, challenging various aspects of the proceedings. Washington State's death penalty itself became the subject of significant legal scrutiny in subsequent years. In 2014, Governor Jay Inslee imposed a moratorium on executions in Washington, meaning no executions would be carried out while he was in office. In 2018, the Washington State Supreme Court struck down the state's death penalty statute as applied, ruling in a separate case, State v. Gregory, that the arbitrary manner in which the death penalty was imposed violated the state constitution's prohibition on cruel punishment. As a result of that ruling, death sentences in Washington, including Yates's, were converted to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Robert Lee Yates, Jr. is currently serving multiple life sentences in the Washington State Correctional System. He will not be released. The broader accounting of what he allegedly did, across decades, across state lines, is something that investigators and journalists have worked to document, though the full picture remains, in some ways, incomplete. Law enforcement in other jurisdictions examined unsolved cases in light of Yates's history, and there were findings and admissions that extended the geography of his alleged violence to locations far from Spokane. The confirmed and adjudicated record, however, is anchored in Washington State. 13 guilty pleas, one murder conviction at trial, sentences that ensure he will die in custody. What lingers, after all of it, is something that doesn't resolve cleanly into a lesson or a moral, because real life rarely cooperates with that kind of tidiness. What lingers is the memory of those women, the ones who were found along the highways, in the fields, in the brush at the edges of roads that people drove every day without knowing. Sherry Palmer and Jennifer Joseph and Connie LaFontaine Ellis and all the others, whose names deserve to be spoken and remembered, not because of how they died, but because of who they were. Women who had people who loved them. Women who existed fully and completely in the world before the world failed to protect them. There is a conversation, long overdue in many communities, about the victims who don't receive the attention they deserve, whose disappearances generate fewer headlines, whose cases move more slowly through systems not designed with them in mind. The Spokane cases are, in part, a document of that failure. The task force worked hard, and the science ultimately delivered accountability. But years passed. Women died during those years. And the question of whether things might have moved differently, faster, with more resources and more urgency, if the victims had occupied a different place in society's hierarchy of concern. That question does not go away when a sentence is handed down. It tends to stay. What the detectives in that Spokane lab did when the DNA result came back and the name appeared on the screen was the job. They did it well. They built a case that held. The science worked. The system ultimately worked. But the women who were lost along those highways in eastern Washington were owed more than ultimate accountability. They were owed protection. And that is something no verdict, however just, can fully provide. Their names remain. Our next case takes us to Lenexa, Kansas. There is a moment in the summer of 2000 when a Johnson County detective stands at the edge of a storage unit in Raymore, Missouri, and watches as investigators pry open a pair of steel barrels. The smell reaches them before anything else. Inside, they find what they have been looking for, and also what they had feared. Two women, gone from the world for years, their families left to wonder. The detective will later say that in 20 years of law enforcement, nothing quite prepared him for the arithmetic of that morning. The barrels, the women, the dawning realization of how long this had been going on, and how carefully the man responsible had arranged his life so that no one would ever look. That man was John Edward Robinson, Sr., neighbor, civic volunteer, husband, grandfather, and, prosecutors would argue, one of the most prolific and methodical serial killers in American history. To understand what was taken, you have to understand who these women were. Lisa Stacy was 21 years old in January of 1985, a young mother navigating a desperate stretch of her life with a four-month-old daughter named Tiffany. She had recently left an abusive relationship and was staying at a women's shelter in the Kansas City area, hoping to find a foothold. By all accounts, she was loving, determined, and frightened in the particular way that young mothers are frightened when they are alone and the world feels large and indifferent. She had her whole future arranged in front of her, unformed and possible. Someone introduced her to a man who said he ran a charitable program to help women like her, a program that would give her job training, a place to stay, a genuine new start. That man was John Robinson. Paula Godfrey was 19 in 1984. A young woman who had accepted what she believed was a job offer from Robinson's company. She told her family she was leaving for a new opportunity. They never heard from her again. Catherine Clampett was 27 in 1987, also connected to Robinson through promises of employment. She, too, vanished. Isabel Lewicka was 21 when she disappeared in 1999, a young woman from Indiana who had met Robinson online and relocated to Kansas City, drawn by what she believed was a relationship and a future. Beverly Bonner, 40, had been a prison librarian who met Robinson when he was briefly incarcerated in the late 1980s. She later corresponded with him, and by 1994, she had left her life in Missouri to follow a set of promises that led only to him. Sheila and Debbie Faith, a mother and her teenage daughter, Debbie wheelchair-bound due to spina bifida, vanished together in 1994 after connecting with Robinson through a pen pal advertisement that promised friendship and support. Suzette Troughton was 27 years old when she disappeared in the spring of 2000. She was a nurse from Michigan who had met Robinson in an online chat room, drawn into what she understood to be a relationship. She had told her mother she was going to work for a wealthy man who needed a caretaker for his ailing father and who was offering a generous salary and travel. She had written her mother letters about the arrangement, excited and hopeful. Those letters stopped coming in March of 2000. Each of these women came from different places and different circumstances. What they shared in the reconstruction of investigators and prosecutors was that John Robinson had found them at a moment of transition or vulnerability and had offered them something that looked from the outside exactly like help. John Robinson was born in 1943 in Cicero, Illinois, and by the time he settled in the Kansas City suburb of Lenexa in the 1960s, he had already begun the lifelong project of constructing a self. He cultivated the image of a businessman with connections, a man of standing. He dressed well and spoke confidently and knew how to make people feel that they were in the presence of someone who had things handled. He served on civic committees. He organized events. He smiled in photographs with local dignitaries. The reality, documented in court records spanning decades, was substantially different. Robinson had been convicted of theft and fraud multiple times going back to the 1960s. Schemes involving embezzlement, fraudulent checks, misrepresentation. He was a con artist, a practiced deceiver who had learned early that a convincing surface was worth more than any underlying substance. When he was released from various periods of incarceration and supervision, he simply adjusted the surface and began again. In the mid-1980s, prosecutors argued, the deception graduated to something irreversible. The disappearances began, at least as far as the documented record reaches, with Paula Godfrey in 1984. When her family reported her missing, Robinson produced letters, purportedly written by Paula, explaining that she had chosen to move on and start over and did not want to be found. The letters satisfied investigators enough, at least temporarily, to close the inquiry. This became a pattern. Each time a woman disappeared from Robinson's orbit, letters would materialize. Letters in the missing woman's name, informing families or social service agencies that everything was fine, that the writer had made a fresh start, that no one should worry. The letters were polished and plausible. For years they worked. The case of Lisa Stassi and her daughter Tiffany carries its own particular dimension of grief. After Lisa disappeared in January 1985, her infant daughter also vanished. Robinson told Lisa's family that both of them had been placed in a program and relocated for their safety. What actually happened, prosecutors argued, and what the jury found, was that Robinson murdered Lisa Stassi and then gave the baby to his own brother and sister-in-law, Don and Helen Robinson, who were unable to have children and who had been led to believe the adoption was legal. They named the girl Heather. She grew up in a loving home, not knowing. It was not until the investigation in 2000 that Heather Robinson, then 15 years old, learned that her biological mother had been murdered, allegedly, by the uncle who had placed her with her adoptive parents. The discovery, reported extensively in the Kansas City Star and in national coverage of the case, stands as one of the more shattering human details of what Robinson left behind. The investigation that finally unraveled Robinson's operation began not with a cold case review or a tip from a neighbor, but with a complaint filed in the spring of 2000 by a woman who had survived an encounter with him. Investigators in Lenexa and Johnson County, Kansas, had begun quietly looking at Robinson in connection with missing persons reports that had accumulated around his name over the years. The disappearance of Suzette Trouton in early 2000 sharpened the focus considerably. Her mother, Carolyn, was insistent and vocal about the fact that her daughter had not simply chosen to disappear. She kept calling. She kept asking. In the meantime, Robinson had continued corresponding with women online. In the late 1990s, the internet had opened a new theater of operation for him. Chat rooms and personal ads through which he could find women from across the country without ever leaving his suburban home. He was skilled at this, presenting himself variously as a businessman, a benefactor, and a dominant partner in relationships with women who sought that dynamic. Investigators, working with women who had been in contact with Robinson and who had grown alarmed, began building a picture. The complaint that tipped the operational timeline came from a woman in Kansas City who told investigators that Robinson had assaulted her and stolen property from her. This gave law enforcement the legal footing they needed to move. In June of 2000, investigators executed search warrants on Robinson's rural property in Linn County, Kansas, and on a storage facility he rented in Raymore, Missouri. What they found in those locations defined the case. On the farm in Linn County, investigators discovered three steel barrels containing the remains of three women. The storage facility in Raymore yielded two more barrels, containing two additional sets of remains. All told, eight sets of human remains were ultimately identified, corresponding to the women who had been reported missing across nearly two decades. The women were identified through forensic analysis, dental records, and DNA comparison. The barrels, investigators noted, had been treated with a lime-like substance consistent with an attempt to accelerate decomposition. John Robinson was arrested in June of 2000. He was 61 years old. The investigation in the months between Robinson's arrest and trial was exhaustive. Prosecutors in Kansas and Missouri both pursued charges, given that some of the victims and some of the evidence crossed state lines. Kansas prosecutors charged Robinson with capital murder in the deaths of Isabel Lewicka and Suzette Trouton, along with first-degree murder in the death of Beverly Bonner. Missouri prosecutors charged him with three additional first-degree murders. The evidence assembled by the prosecution was, by the time it reached the courtroom, extensive. Investigators documented the paper trail of forged letters Robinson had used for years to forestall inquiries. They traced financial accounts. Robinson had continued cashing disability checks issued in the name of Sheila Faith and her daughter Debbie for years after their deaths, a documented piece of fraud that also served as evidence of when they had been killed. They gathered testimony from women who had been in contact with Robinson online and in person and had escaped harm, who described his methods of approach and manipulation. They presented forensic evidence from the farm and the storage facility, and they traced the circumstances of baby Tiffany, now Heather, back through the records to Lisa Stassi's disappearance in 1985. The Kansas trial began in October of 2002. The defense argued that Robinson was not responsible for the deaths, that the evidence was circumstantial in key areas, and attempted to challenge forensic conclusions. Prosecutors methodically walked the jury through the totality of the evidence, the victims, the letters, the barrels, the financial fraud, the pattern of behavior reaching across 15 years. The jury deliberated and returned with its verdict in October of 2002. Guilty of capital murder in the deaths of Isabel Lewicka and Suzette Trouton, and guilty of first-degree murder in the death of Beverly Bonner. In the penalty phase, the same jury recommended death. The judge sentenced Robinson to death on the capital counts in January of 2003. In Missouri, Robinson subsequently entered an Alford plea, a legal mechanism by which a defendant pleads guilty without formally admitting guilt, to three additional murders, those of Lisa Stacy, Paula Godfrey, and Catherine Clampett, among others covered under the Missouri charges. He received three consecutive life sentences in Missouri under that arrangement, an outcome that also ensured those victims' families received some measure of formal legal acknowledgement of what had been done. Robinson appealed his Kansas convictions through the state appellate system, arguing numerous grounds, including challenges to jury selection, evidentiary rulings, and the handling of the penalty phase. The Kansas Supreme Court reviewed the case extensively. In 2016, the court upheld the convictions and the death sentence, affirming the conclusions of the jury and the conduct of the trial. Subsequent federal habeas corpus proceedings have continued, as is standard in capital cases, and Robinson has remained on Kansas death row as those processes run their course. As of the most recent available reporting, no execution date has been set, and the case remains in the post-conviction review phase that characterizes American capital litigation. He is now in his early 80s. He has never, by any documented account, offered a complete explanation of what he did or why. There is something that stays with you when you spend time with the documented record of this case, and it is not the barrels or the forensic detail or even the extraordinary span of time, 15 years during which this was happening in the quiet margins of suburban life. What stays is the letters. John Robinson understood, with a predator's precision, that the people who loved these women would worry, that they would call, that they would look. And so he wrote the letters, careful, plausible, final-sounding letters in the voices of the dead, telling the living to stop looking. He weaponized the love of families against them, turned their hope into an instrument of concealment. Paula Godfrey's parents read a letter in their daughter's name and were reassured enough to wait. Beverly Bonner's family received correspondence suggesting she was traveling and thriving. Carolyn Troughton received word in her daughter Suzette's apparent voice that everything was wonderful. The letters are what mark the particular coldness of the calculation, documented in court record after court record, the understanding that human beings want to believe the best, and that a skilled forger of surfaces can exploit that want for years. The women whose lives were taken had each, in their way, been looking for something, a job, a relationship, a safe landing, a new beginning. That search is not a failing. It is the most human thing there is, the reaching toward possibility. John Robinson found them in that reaching and used it against them. The jury in Johnson County, Kansas, found him guilty. The courts of Kansas upheld that finding. The record of who these women were, Lisa, Paula, Catherine, Beverly, Sheila, Debbie, Isabel, Suzette, is part of the public record now, attached not to their hope but to their names, which is perhaps the smallest and most necessary form of restoration the law can offer. Tiffany Stassi, who grew up as Heather Robinson in a home that loved her, has spoken publicly about the circumstances of her origins in the years since. She carries something no one should have to carry. But she is here, and she knows her mother's name, and that, against everything, is something. That's three cases for today. From all of us at Intelligix, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.